Morning, everybody, and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to me, David_Lundgren@HancockBank.com. And this morning, we have with us John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer, and myself, David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, and Jeff Tangus, all investment directors. And Jeff, we'll go ahead and get started with you. I guess during the month, we've had quite a big policy announcement, the biggest possibly. Could be that the Fed announced the third round of quantitative easing. And round three differs a bit from previous programs. So if you could maybe discuss some of the details and the possible implications, both short-term and long-term.
I'd be happy to, Dave. Well, welcome everybody this morning. We have entered a brave new world as far as the Federal Reserve is concerned. We've talked about the Federal Reserve almost every meeting now for as long as I can remember us doing these calls. But you would think they had pulled every rabbit out of their hat that they could, but they managed to come up with a new twist, no pun intended there, on Fed quantitative easing and Fed accommodation. Basically what happened was the Fed had watched a great deal of economic data come across lately, and the news was generally weak. Unemployment remained stuck above 8%, and there was weakness in data throughout the economy, really, except with except for the housing market, perhaps. That seems to be one bright spot that's showing some improvement. But after that, it was starting to concern the Fed. So what the Fed did was, and they knew that, as we've talked about before, that they have to make a bigger splash each and every time to get everybody's attention. The old analogy of like using a drug to cure a disease, every time you use it, you build up a little bit of a resistance to it. Well, the Fed realizes that QE was developing a great deal of resistance, so it knew it had to do something new and different and more bold and innovative than anything it had done before. So what it announced it would do in the new round of quantitative easing, or QE3, as it has been what people have come to know it as, they said that they were going to start buying securities, which is what QE is all about, in the open market. But this time, they did not set a specific dollar amount or a specific time. In other words, they said we're going to buy roughly $40 billion a month, and we're going to do that as long as it takes till we start to see some significant improvement in the unemployment numbers. And they also said that even after the employment numbers improve, they may not stop right away. They clearly showed a sign that they are now more interested in the employment side of their dual mandate as opposed to the price stability side. And that did get everybody's attention, for sure. Again, their emphasis is on the mortgage side, because they see housing as the what may in fact save the economy ultimately, and so it has had a dramatic impact on mortgage rates, and Luther, I think, will talk about that in a little while. So it's a whole new ballgame as far as the Fed is concerned. Obviously, they're looking at a lot of data that we see, and perhaps some data that we don't get to see. And they're concerned about the economy in general. So they took a step that they've never taken before, and it brings back to mind the old saw that you don't fight the Fed, and for sure that is that's what I think the markets have decided, is that the Fed has an unlimited amount of bullets, and it looks like it's willing to use as much as it takes to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish, which is lower unemployment.
So I guess the obvious question, I'll throw this out to you and John, you talked about, you know, less concern about price stability. Does that mean inflation is on the horizon, or is that kind of an unknown?
Well, I'll take a first stab at it. What it means is they're probably willing to take some short-term increase in inflation. I don't think they want to see structural inflation rise dramatically, but they are willing to tolerate it for a short period of time before they really start to pull back on their quantitative easing. John, do you have much to add to that?
Only that one of the things we need to watch fairly carefully is the velocity of money or the turnover of money, and not only here, but I guess in the European markets too. And so far, the velocity or turnover of money has been relatively low and falling, and that's been the case really since the crash of 2008. So in effect, the Fed is, as they say, pushing on a string. Something similar is happening in Europe, so there appears to be quite a bit of room for the Fed to maintain an easy policy. As long as the transition from easy money to actually, you know, seeing borrowing, spending, and lending, you know, situation improve to the point where you're generating inflation. Obviously, it's going to be something very tricky for them to get out of, and you know, when it's time to get out of it, if inflation does begin to increase later. And of course, there are fears in some circles that the very fact of that they are maintaining a very easy policy and maintaining a zero interest rate policy will, in and of itself, tend to suppress economic activity. So, you know, the argument continues about whether it's necessary, and if it is necessary, what are the long-term consequences? And, you know, I guess it's just something we're going to have to work through and navigate through as best we can from an investment standpoint.
Dave, there was one other point that I think it's important to make about the Fed, in that the Fed is generally comprised, the voting members of the Fed are generally comprised of people who are very hawkish on inflation. In other words, they've always got an eye on inflation, and then a number of people who are more interested in the employment side of the equation. Well, it seems that from what we can glean now that almost everybody is on board with QE3. Everybody's concerned about unemployment, and so that's an unusual thing for the Fed to have that much unanimity among the voting members.
Okay, great. John, let's you touched on Europe, and let's go ahead and head there. You know, in addition to the Fed announcement here, there are a lot of news in the Eurozone. We received some clarification on Draghi's Whatever It Takes bond purchase program. We had the Dutch elections, and then finally the German court ruled on the constitutionality of Eurozone's permanent rescue fund. If you could, bring us up to date.
The things that Dave just mentioned were potential roadblocks in the working of Draghi's new plan, and those roadblocks have been removed. So, or at least it seems that they have been removed. So everybody in Europe, and I guess a general word around the world, was that these steps have probably created a way for the groundwork to be laid for a more permanent solution and sort of take the crisis, or I guess soften the crisis for a period of time. However, in the weeks following these events, we've all seen domestic unrest begin to pick up again in Spain and Greece. There's talk that they're still having a problem coming to grips with, you know, how they would implement this particular process. So it's almost like same old, I guess. You know, the crisis will continue. They're trying to work out something in the interim that will allow them to think about a long-term solution. How much time do they have to get this worked out before things really begin to get critical again? Nobody really knows. The latest estimates I've seen have been maybe 3-4 months. That's about all the time they have to really come up with a solution before things get a little bit nasty again. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem very likely that they'll get everything worked out in 3 or 4 months. So everybody is kind of concerned that they really don't have enough time to come up with a permanent solution. When you do the math is pretty daunting. The last number I saw indicated it would take about $2 trillion to really more or less wipe out the crisis and allow it to go forward into you know, some kind of, I guess, more inflationary environment, but they don't really have $2 trillion. And Italy, Spain, Greece, Portugal, I guess, maybe not so much Ireland, but those other countries have cultural issues that sort of preclude deciding to go in the direction of higher growth, I guess, and restructuring their economies from the standpoint of how they really do things. And nobody thinks that's going to be a near-term solution, maybe a long-term solution. So we go back to the bottom line that everybody talks about, which is at some point they're going to have to make the decision to break the thing up probably into maybe a northern tier and a southern tier as far as the euro is concerned, because the euro is really too expensive. And, you know, for some of those countries, they need a cheaper dollar or a cheaper currency of some sort to allow them to really become more competitive. So I guess we're going to have to live with this for some time in the future.
You mentioned 3 or 4 months, you know, things possibly, you know, could be coming to a head there. Coincidentally enough, we also have the fiscal cliff, and we'll definitely have a new Congress, possibly a new administration. Let's talk a little bit about the election. You know, the conventions are both done, and getting ready for the presidential debates. Give us an update on where things stand on the election.
The Rasmussen poll is generally considered to be one of the better polls out there, and Rasmussen apparently, from what I can read about his history, has had perhaps more success than some of the other polling organizations in the you know, accuracy of his predictions. Right now, the race is neck and neck, according to Rasmussen. You might have two percentage points plus or minus for Romney or Obama from one week to the next, depending on when the latest poll was taken. Rasmussen believes that the ability for a significant change in the polls could occur between now and the election, that we're coming into the season of the debates and, you know, some more, you know, where the candidates really become more focused on some of the things they want to emphasize. So we could see some changes coming up. Unfortunately, the general betting, if you look at Intrade, the site where you can bet real money on the outcome of elections, that shows Obama a very large favorite. It doesn't necessarily tell you that's what's going to happen, because that's where all the money flow is going in terms of the betting. But it does suggest what everybody thinks. And if you survey people on Wall Street, and we don't do the surveys, but we get the research reports from the street that give us some idea of what people are thinking. The general thinking on Wall Street is that Obama has a higher probability of being reelected than Romney.
Yeah.
So that's what the belief is at the moment.
The other thing I noticed on Intrade is that in addition to the major shift to where on Intrade, Obama is a heavy favorite now opposed to kind of middle of the road, there's been a major shift also in control of the Senate to where it appears that the odds have increased significantly that the Senate will be controlled by the Democrats, and I think a lot of that has to do with the Missouri race. Anything of importance there that we should note?
Not beyond that, Dave, what you said. It the odds used to be much better. I don't know what they are now. There's something, 55% maybe, that the Democrats will retain the Senate.
I think it's even a little bit more than that.
Maybe
now,
more
yeah.
than that now.
So, and I guess, you know, the fiscal cliff, we've talked about that on recent calls, and I guess there's no real progress there, and that's, you know, we're just kind of sitting on hold until after the elections and then possibly after inauguration.
Could be. I mean, it could run into January. And obviously that's, you know, something of a risk for the economy. Apparently it's already reflected in the economic data to some degree, given surveys we've seen from chief executive officers and what you get from the small business folks in terms of their decisions based on holding back on projects and whatnot, and because they just have a great deal of uncertainty about what the policies and what the taxes are going to be like. I did some work the other day to try to figure out what the impact on GDP might be from taxes that aren't necessarily represented by the fiscal cliff. So I tried to find some data related to just the return of FICA, for example. We haven't had that tax, you know, coming out of salaries in a while. Things connected to the Affordable Care Act that will be instituted next year and so forth. And these don't seem, these are kind of outside of the fiscal cliff, you know, in that we're not talking about going back to higher rates. They're just new taxes. If those new taxes go in, you know, based on what I was able to come up with, you've got maybe $150 billion of new taxes next year coming out of the economy. And so I guess if a lot of the fiscal cliff is solved and we still have sort of a curve out there to trip over, some people that we talk to suggest that these taxes outside of those automatically going up after, you know, if something's not done about the fiscal cliff issue, could take about 1% out of GDP next year. I have no idea whether those numbers are correct or not, but at least it does look like there will be a negative impact on taxes of some kind, even if the fiscal cliff is moderated to some degree. So it looks like 2013 is going to start off probably, you know, pretty soft, or certainly there doesn't appear to be a significant increase in economic activity early next year, even if things work out fairly well.
Okay, thanks. You know, I guess another interesting thing is that despite all of the risks and concerns that we've been discussing on these calls, you know, for months, the stock market continues to climb the wall of worry. September was yet another good month for stocks. The S&P 500 advanced 2.6%, and amazingly, year to date, the S&P 500 is up over 16%. But what do you think is the driver? Is it QE3? No other place for money to go? What exactly is going on that we have all these risks and concerns out there, but yet we continue to see market indices advance?
I think you hit on two. One, we probably offer the best opportunity for equity investing at the present, unless you're looking at some of the emerging markets in Asia, possibly. I mean, I've heard people say nice things about the Philippines and Indonesia, but obviously, people are not going to make huge bets on the Philippines and Indonesia, and that leaves perhaps you know, the United States as a good place for you know, investments to flow, because you know, we still have, you know, reasonably decent GDP growth compared to what's happening in Europe and some areas around the world. So that's probably part of it. QE is probably another part of it. There's a psychological factor in the market that is certainly probably more prominent now than it has been in the past, in that you don't fight the Fed. Whenever the Fed is easy, and when they're really easy, you're better off to buy stocks because stocks are going up, because some of this easy money is going to leak into the market in some fashion. And when you look back at the QEs we've had in the past, the 2008-2009 easy money policy was probably necessary to avoid a financial meltdown. And so that probably was quite useful in preventing us from falling off of a cliff financially. But as the recovery progressed and new attempts to, you know, ease monetary policy were less effective as far as the economy is concerned, or at least when the economists try to tear the data apart, they can only find a marginal influence. Now here we are at QE3. The markets have moved a little bit higher based on that, but not so much. And there's quite a bit of doubt among the economic community as to whether or not this particular, you know, QE experience will really generate that much more from an economic standpoint. So, you know, it is kind of surprising that we've come this far in a time when earnings momentum is decelerating for the market generally, and you're looking at, let's say, single-digit earnings gains, for example, going forward at best, you know, rather than double-digit gains, and you're not getting much of an improvement in price-earnings multiples. So it is kind of odd, I guess, that we've come this far. Is the market expensive at this point? not terribly. I mean, the market was expensive in late 2007. You know, we're nowhere near that area now in terms of the market being expensive. Kind of neutral, I guess, would be a good way to describe where we are from a valuation standpoint. But
I know it's hard to predict, but, you know, I was of the thinking that the market was anticipating this third round of quantitative easing, and I really thought the market reaction would be, you know, a non-event because it was expected. We've seen two previous rounds. The fact that this quantitative easing program is different, and I've heard people refer to it as QE infinity. It's just kind of open-ended until they get results that they want. Is that going to is that not only, you know, the rally since we saw its announcement, although it's small, we've seen the market move up, but is that potential to propel the market going forward out there because of how the program is structured? I mean, we could be in quantitative easing for, you know, 12 to 18 months. Who knows when it ends?
Yeah, that's possible. In fact, there is an attitude beginning to permeate Wall Street, if we can refer to Wall Street, I guess, as the investment community, that we are at QE infinity, QE forever. And down the road, it might generate inflation, you know, maybe not for a while. And even if the economy doesn't really, you know, move ahead that rapidly due to what the Fed is doing, you buy stocks anyway because it's the only game in town. Now, that doesn't sound necessarily very attractive to conservative investors, but that's what the betting is. The
yeah.
betting seems to be shifting to the fact that it's QE forever. You might as well own common stocks because maybe down the road you'll get a price earnings multiple increase just because of the money flow going in. Now, what that suggests, of course, is that if the economy does not come on strong enough to generate fundamental support for the market, it's possible we could get into another semi-bubble or quasi-bubble situation where the market becomes overvalued again relative to fundamentals, which might, you know, require some sort of decision from an asset allocation standpoint. We're not there yet, but I suppose that is, you know, a possibility going forward. But again, it probably depends on what industries you own and what stocks and that sort of thing.
Okay. Great. Luther, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk about bonds. I was kind of looking at the yield graph of the 10-year during the month, and it was amazing. It was almost a mirror image of what happened in August. We started the month around 155 on the 10-year, climbed to almost 1.9% by mid-month, only to fall back to 1.6%. What's going on with this intra-month volatility?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with some of the things that have already been mentioned here. As noted, last month we had Draghi come out and say we're going to do whatever it takes. We had Dutch elections. We had the German court rulings. You can also throw in there the fact that gas prices were on the rise, that we had some droughts in the Midwest and crop prices were on the rise. We had, at least at the beginning of the month, there were some that had some concern that the Fed would not enter into any additional quantitative easing. So what you saw in the beginning of the month was interest rates start to rise. A lot of that was the risk on trade again, in that, you know, Europe's going to be okay, stocks are the place to be, and there was a sell-off in bonds. But for the month, the peak actually occurred the day the Fed announced QE3. And like you said earlier, the reaction seems to be a little bit overdone. But then on the flip side, you know, maybe some of those people who didn't think it was going to happen were truly surprised. So what we've seen is with the announcement of QE3, rates have dropped back down to where we are. I would expect to see continued volatility just like we've had over the last 2 months as we continue back and forth with Spain is going to present a program to the ECB to get money, but Spain doesn't want to present the program until the ECB tells it what kind of penalties or how austere it's going to have to be, and we're going back and forth there, so we should continue to see volatility. The one thing that we that is clearly evident over the course of the later part of last month was that mortgage-backed security spreads, where, as Jeff has mentioned, the Fed is putting all of its money, have tightened rather dramatically. Going into the month, mortgage-backed securities versus treasuries, the spread was about 100 basis points, maybe a little bit more. So you could pick up almost 1% buying a mortgage-backed security, an agency mortgage-backed security, versus a comparable treasury. But with the Fed out there buying all these mortgages, the spread has tightened up anywhere from, you know, now it's at 80 basis points to 90 basis points over the treasury. So we've seen a tightening of anywhere from 20 to 25 basis points, depending upon where you are on the curve. But, you know, it's just one day it's good news, the next day it's bad news. It tends to roll on for a couple of weeks, and then we flip around and we do it again.
Yeah. Okay. Jeff, anything to add on the fixed income side?
Well, I'd point out to anybody who owns a house that if you want to go out and get a 30-year mortgage right now, the average across the country is about 3.4% on a 30-year mortgage, 2.73% on a 15-year mortgage. So it's an unprecedented time. Those are historical. As long as they've kept records, we've never had mortgage rates this low. So if you've got a house and your rate's probably 4.5% or higher, it probably makes sense to refinance.
Jeff, did our mortgage department ask you to do that commercial?
That was an unpaid announcement.
Hey, Jeff.
Yes.
How difficult is it to get those mortgages?
Well, John, honestly, not having gone through the process, I don't know firsthand. I'm told anecdotally that it is pretty rigorous. It was very rigorous coming out of 2008. It was almost impossible to qualify under the new Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines. And then the appraisers were making it even more difficult because they would come in and tell you your house was worth a lot less than it probably really was. So, but I hear that has loosened up pretty dramatically too. So it's more difficult certainly than it was pre-2008, but it's getting better. So. So it makes sense for anybody that has a mortgage at 4.5% to at least go give it a shot.
All right, great. Thank you, Jeff. We don't have any questions submitted at this point. If you have a question, please go ahead and email me at david_lundgren@hancockbank.com. And, John, we just have a minute or two here. I know they had the UN General Assembly over the last week or so, and a lot of political posturing in regards to the Israel-Iran potential conflict or conflict. Anything newsworthy to point out there?
I haven't seen anything really new on that situation, not anything that people wouldn't be able to pick up in the news on their own. I do have a subscription to Stratfor. That's the old strategic forecast, and they try to keep up with what's going on around the world and movements of troops and planes and whatnot. And recently they sent out an alert indicating that there were some unusual movements of American and French assets to Africa and the Middle East, and they really didn't know why, but they just brought that to everybody's attention. So for whatever it's worth, that's the latest, and it's not very much, but at least it shows that, you know, the crisis hasn't gone away.
Yeah, and still kind of looms as a mm-hmm. potential risk. Okay, I guess we'll go ahead and conclude there. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we'll look forward to speaking with you next month.